Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our deputy editor, Matt Mayton.
Hello.
Hello. And our contributor, Ashanti Omka. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. And this week we are weighing up Retro Return Scream, Feel Good Real Lifer Save the Cinema, Brain Scrambler Memoria, Andrea Arnold's Cow, and Shakespeare reimagining The Tragedy of Macbeth. That's a lot to get through. But before we do get onto those, what have you guys been watching this week aside from all of those? Shanti, what have you been feasting your eyes on?
Well, Boiling Point has been my kind of film, because I think anyone who follows me on socials knows my love for food. And this is set in a restaurant. It's done in one take. And I mean, to do this in one continuous take just completely blew my mind. I mean, Stephen Graham, this man, I mean, we've seen him in This Is England, and you just see a different avatar, and you know how versatile he is when you see him as this chef who's got all these problems going on, busiest day of the year, and everything is going wrong. And Bradford-born actress Vinette Robinson, she was Pilot Tice in Star Wars, The Rise of the Skywalker. She was Sergeant Sally Donovan in Sherlock and Abby Lerner in Doctor Who. And she as his sous chef. Whoa.
Yeah, she's great, isn't she? I didn't know she was from Bradford. I should have recognised that accent. Hometown of Bradford. She is great in this, though. She really is the sort of the anchor of this whole sort of disastrous night, isn't she? And I really feel for her. No spoilers, but there's a scene where she just says, you know, she has to sort of give in to something, a situation. It's a really sad and emotional and impactful scene. Matt, what have you been watching? Have you been watching foodie things?
No, like, to give a slightly annoying answer first, I saw some footage from an upcoming film, which I'm not really allowed to say what it is, but I absolutely loved it. Like, it was kind of like 30 minutes of footage. And if the rest of the film is as good as that, it's going to be one of my favourite films of the year. But
wait, we've got a super secret screening next week of another film that could be your film of the year.
That's another film,
which we can't say.
Equally possible, one thing I can say that I saw, which is another contender for my kind of top films of the year, I'm sure this will end up high on my list at the end of the year, is The Worst Person in the World, which I caught, which is kind of played some festivals, and it's not out here for a little while, a couple of months, but I absolutely love that as well. I don't know if either of you guys have seen it, but
it's playing at Sundance, and I am doing Sundance this year. Sadly not in the snow in real life, because it has been made a virtual festival. So yes, I will be definitely catching up with that, because I've heard amazing things about it. So
I would highly recommend it.
I saw it recently as well for the awards season. And yes, I mean, the performance is there on point. And the name, that's a weird name, actually, in the world. It doesn't quite fit in with what happens in the film, right?
It's a strange title. It does have a title drop in the film, I think.
Yes.
At some point.
Yes, it does.
But yes, I agree. It's an odd choice.
Obvious one.
I don't know if it plays differently in Norwegian, because it's like a Norwegian film.
This is true. I wonder if subtitles are kind of giving us...
Maybe the title kind of has a different sort of resonance over there, but I absolutely loved it. It was one of those films that really sort of stuck with me, and it's on the longer side. It's over 2 hours, but I just could have had it longer even, you know. I just loved it. It's kind of broken down into lots of little chapters, and I just loved every chapter.
Well, that's out in March, so we will be reviewing it. Time to move on now, and it's time to get creepy. Don't answer the phone, guys. It's this.
Hello?
It's happening.
3 attacks so far. Do you have a gun?
I'm Sydney Prescott. Of course I have a gun.
Something about this one just feels different.
So this is Scream, not Scream 5. They've just used the normal title of the first original one. Tell us about this, Matt. You interviewed the directors and all of the cast for our cover feature of this. Explain to us where we find the residents of Woodsboro.
I did indeed, yes. And I was someone who kind of grew up on the Scream films as well. So especially, I mean, particularly the first one, I just absolutely loved the first one. And it was one of those sort of formative, like, film experiences for me, where just the idea of this film where everyone's kind of talking about films and, you know, referencing other films, I just absolutely loved. And it sort of blew my mind. So it will always kind of have a special place in my heart. This one is kind of a legacy sequel, kind of, they call it a requel in the film, where it's sort of half reboot, half sequel. And we're sort of back in Woodsboro We open in classic Scream style with someone receiving a creepy phone call and it turning sort of, you know, very nasty after that. And then after this kind of opening scene, we then, it's hard to really say because I don't want to give too much away. And I don't know if this will be true of all screenings, you know, of the film in all cinemas, but at our press screening, it kind of opened with Roger L. Jackson doing the scary voice, basically telling us not to give any spoilers. So you sort of want to tread a bit lightly, but basically we pick up after that opening thing where obviously someone has taken on the ghost face mantle again. And, you know, obviously we know what we're in for, a new spate of killings. And it seems like there's a connection, like everyone who's being attacked, they seemingly have some connection to people who've been attacked previously, like in the kind of, you know, what we saw in the original films. And the main character, if we say there is a main character, is Melissa Barrera's Sam. And you might recognize her from In the Heights. And she's been away from Woodsboro, but she returns for sort of personal reasons. She has a kind of personal connection to this. And then it's just kind of how it unfolds from there. And we have a new sort of whole new group of teens who are sort of at the center of it. And obviously we also know from trailers and everything that on the periphery, you've got the kind of classic legacy characters as well. Obviously, most notably Sidney Prescott, played by Neve Campbell. And Dewey, played by David Arquette, is also back. And of course, Gail Weathers, Courtney Cox, is back as well. Yeah, then it's just kind of how this all unfolds. And obviously, kind of course, it's all about the rules of the requel, you know, and what they've got to do to survive. It really very much leans into the whodunit element as well. That's always been a big part of the Scream films. And they really play into the everyone's a suspect. And that's right at the forefront, you know, they're all discussing this, obviously.
The rules are laid out in a very arch fashion and a knowing fashion and, you know, a meta fashion. It's meta but in this one. But do those rules work, you know, this many years after the first one and really, you know, being so self-aware of the franchise? Does it work?
It did for me, actually. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. And again, I say I'm a big fan of films like first one, far and away the best, in my opinion. I'm also a big fan of the second one. Then third and fourth, I can sort of take or leave. But this, I thought, was a worthy sort of legacy sequel. I don't think it will be necessarily, you know, remembered in years to come. But I found it really fun as just revisiting that franchise, playing with the rules in the modern day, you know, updating it for now with kind of, you know, elements of sort of toxic fandom and things like that that are discussed. You know, I found that sort of thing really enjoyable. And as we've got so many kind of legacy sequels at the moment with things like Ghostbusters, Matrix,
Star Wars,
Star Wars, that classic thing where you kind of introduce this new cast but also have the backing of the OGs. So I thought it was the right time for it, and yeah, I enjoyed it. I thought it was kind of funny where it needed to be, tense where it needed to be, and yeah, it was my first cinema trip of the year, actually. And
there you go.
I had a real good time in the cinema.
You had a blast. Did you, Ashanti? Yeah. Did it work for you?
So as a lot of people who know me know, I'm not a huge horror fan and I skipped all the films in the middle. So I'd seen the first one because that was such a cult film. And then in the middle, didn't see any of the films. So I went in and I didn't also bother to watch them, I have to admit, in preparation to see this.
You
one.
Didn't miss anything.
This is what I thought. I'd read a few reviews and I thought, okay, I haven't missed much. I'm going to go in and see it with an open mind. And there were a few things that struck me that I really liked in it. One was this very diverse cast, because the protagonist herself was, you know, she was Latinx and her sister too. So that felt really good to me. There were a lot of kind of female characters with LGBTQ plus leanings that again were shown in a very beautiful way. I feel like there wasn't a lot of, you know, judgment about their sexuality. So that felt good to me. And in terms of this kind of diverse cast coming together, again, from a representation point of view, I quite like that, because there's this actress, Sonia Ben Amar, who is part Tunisian, you know, and it felt like, okay, this town seems to have got a lot of diversity since the first film. That was a big thing that I could see in this. The twins in it, I thought they were super fun. And there were lots of fun bits in it. The screenplay for me Maybe it's because I don't watch a lot of horror films. Maybe I'm not used to this kind of slightly slow moving flat screenplay in some ways, because I think I was like,
I'm surprised you call it slow moving.
To me, it felt like, because I was drifting off thinking of my
dinner.
It felt
like it belted along in a sort of like onto the next stab. And this is perhaps me rather than the film. Maybe I've changed since I saw the first one. I found it difficult to find it entertaining, seeing people being dispatched so coldly and so grossly and bloodily and with so little regard. I know that's how, you know, serial killers operate, but also just that this idea that everybody's either fodder or the killer makes it very difficult to care for anyone, which was always thus. I'm not saying this is a new thing, but I find maybe, you know, there is a lot of discussion about elevated horror and, you know, taking the piss out of people who only enjoy that kind of horror and don't enjoy this kind of horror. And maybe I'm one of those people that you should be taking the piss out of. Perhaps I wanted a little bit more. I didn't just want, you know, these random kids to be, you know, dispatched one by one in various stabby fashions. And also, this is, again, me, I know, but like Halloween Kills, I'm constantly thinking, how is anybody walking having been stabbed that many times in their stomach? How are they even alive? So there's a lot of that sort of thing. So I realize it's completely heightened. I understand that. But for me, I see what you're saying, Matt. I see what you're saying, Shanti, but it felt tired. It felt like we were really like flogging this horse and this was a snake eating its own tail with the meta. I mean, at one point there's a scene, isn't there, where somebody's watching the first scream with Ghostface coming in behind them and they're watching it with Ghostface coming in behind them and they're shouting at the TV to say he's behind you whilst he's behind them. And it's just like, ha ha. But that is essentially what the whole film is. And so that got old for me. Am I just being a grump?
I really get what you mean about the sort of violence aspect, because this is a strange thing that's happened to me a bit as I've got older, that when I was younger, I could literally just obviously watch any slasher and, you know, kind of glory in it. But definitely as I get older, I question these things more. And I particularly found it with Halloween Kills, which is obviously another legacy sequel. I struggled more with that because I suppose with this, it comes with that whole meta commentary on the genre that comes as standard here, because there is that self-awareness and that tongue-in-cheek element. I guess maybe I view it just slightly differently here, but I found with Halloween Kills, because that was so kind of brutal and, you know, just so relentlessly killy, I struggled with that a bit and found that I found it just a bit sort of poor taste almost. But this, I don't know, the sort of humour and just, I suppose, maybe my history with the franchise. And I agree with what you've said. I kind of see where you're coming from in the sense that while it updates the sort of meta elements and things, it doesn't do anything radically different to the kind of existing films. So in that sense, it doesn't come along and just offer something just completely new and different. But then I guess so many people wouldn't want that, really. I guess, you know, so for me it worked as an extra Scream film. I felt like, obviously, again, but based on Halloween, like I wouldn't be surprised if they would try and launch, you know, like a new trilogy, a new series with some of the younger characters or whatever.
I mean, it certainly leaves it open, but, doesn't it?
Yes, but to me, I felt like this was, I really enjoyed this, but I don't necessarily want more. This was just a nice kind of chance for me to revisit that style, revisit Woodsboro, have kind of fun with it again. But yeah, I feel like it's sort of nice to have one for 2022, but I don't feel like I now want another series. But
yeah, you described it when we came out of the cinema as a victory lap, that this was like a victory lap for this franchise rather than a reboot. And that's how you liked it. So will you be disappointed then if another 4 or 5 come along after this?
I mean, yeah, I wouldn't be particularly excited if they announced another one. I would sort of feel like this kind of satisfied what I was after, really, from another Scream film. And maybe if they waited another sort of 20 years and
and it's old age pensioner Gail Weathers then, Sydney is back, but she's got a Zimmer frame.
I have to say, though, seeing those three back together, Courtney Cox, David Arquette and Neve Campbell, that felt good. And just also there was this kind of girl, you know, girl boss element to it with these women working together and all of that. That felt good to me. And I think it gave me a little touch of nostalgia. And I know they were obviously using that as a crux. But like Matt said, I'm not keen to see these characters then go off and do things. I'm not particularly keen on a spin-off, but perhaps a TV series. I don't know. It might work.
As you mentioned there, Ashanti, it was nice seeing those three together. And also, I think that probably was the most emotional part of the film for me, was seeing Courtney Cox and David Arquette reunited in this sort of, you know, the lost marriage and everything. And you can't help but all that, add that layering of the real life scenario that they fell in love on Scream 1 and they divorced by Scream 3 and then they're back together and, you know, they're good friends and co-parents now in real life. But that this sort of sadness and this history felt really tangible. I think that's what I wanted more of and not just the disposable elements.
Agreed.
Mm.
Okay, so I think we're saying if you're a fan of Scream, this is going to, you know, tickle your fancy, isn't it? It's going to get right to the sharp point. And that is out in cinemas on Friday. Okay, next up, it's 1993 and Jurassic Park is about to come out with this.
Find a way to keep it going.
I've decided to go straight to the top.
Dear Mr. Spielberg, showing Jurassic Park will help save the Lyric.
It's part of our history.
Won't get away with this.
You're gonna have to arrest all of us.
Get down from there!
No!
We've got to join the fight to save this place.
You're joking!
It's him! On the phone!
Where there's a will, there's a way.
So this is Save the Cinema. Ashanti, who's saving which cinema?
So this is a true story. I didn't actually go in knowing it was a true story. So I had all these issues with it until I saw it at the end.
You were like, this would never happen. Oh, it did.
Yeah, there were so many aspects to it that I just thought, oh. And then, you know, at the end, I thought, a true story. Okay, it's all going together now. Liz Evans, she's a hairdresser. This was a film that I think a lot of us as film critics can relate to because there are a lot of independent cinemas. Like just recently, Singapore has said they're closing down their independent cinemas. They don't feel that it's a viable business anymore. And of course, we've been seeing so many tropes of gentrification in places where beloved spaces are being turned into shopping malls and houses. And in this one, it's got Adil Akhtar playing a mayor, which I thought was very interesting because you rarely see this kind of an Asian character as a mayor. Tom Felton is in it, and we all saw him in Harry Potter. Jonathan Pryce, Samantha Morton, all of them come together with Susan Wacoma, whom I really, really like. In this film where this lady is a beloved woman in her society, she has been encouraging all these kids to take up theatre and musical theatres, which gives the town a lot of joy. But they just find that this place is a bit run down and there's corruption within the ranks of their city council, and they just want to shut it down, kind of have a wrecking ball and just kind of close this place down and rebuild. And this is when she decides to kind of move in there with her own hairdressing salon and save the place. Felt like a TV drama to me, and it's made to come out on Sky TV. So that all kind of made sense to me. And it has a sweet, sweet, sweet element because, you know, she wants to show Jurassic Park and they want to be the first to see this film. And they feel that that's the campaign that'll save the cinema. And I don't want to give you the spoilers, but let's just say that it is quite a heartening story of this woman who had this determination. And that for me really worked. There were flaws, but hey, what film doesn't have flaws?
I mean, this is very much a, as you say, it's sweet, sweet, sweet. We are not trying to be gritty. There is nothing really very surprising in this, is there? Even though it is a true story, it does adhere to all of those rules. If we're going on the Scream rules, the rules of heartwarming, feel good, Calendar Girls, Dream Horse, those sort of films. Did you like it, Matt? Did it touch the sweet spot for you?
Well, it was a weird one because it was almost problematic that I did know of the true story beforehand, having sort of read a bit about the film. And I sort of wish I'd have just known a bit less going in, maybe, because, you know, it's kind of predictable enough as it is, but let alone when you actually know the story. But all that said, it's exceptionally undemanding. But I'd be lying if I said I didn't sort of, you know, like have some sort of warm feelings towards it, because it's just so easy to like, it's obviously, you know, easy to root for it, you know, a film that's about kind of saving cinemas, especially at a time like now. It's sort of, you know, like charmingly played by most of the cast. Like I really like Samantha Morton. It was nice to kind of, you know, see her in this kind of role, really sort of warm kind of matriarch and sort of like the mum to the whole town almost. And I sort of like that vibe. Got a bit of a sort of twinkly Jonathan Pryce in there as well. Some quite wild Welsh accents, as we've sort of discussed.
Yes. They are not all from, you know, the same part of Wales. No. I think we could be generous by saying.
So if you want real authenticity when it comes to like your Welsh accents, maybe go somewhere else. But I kind of, you know, it was just perfectly fine. Like there was just something sort of sweet about it and undemanding. And, you know, whilst I wouldn't give it sort of any more than, say, like 3 stars for those reasons, I found it a pleasant enough watch, I must say.
It's something weird, though, isn't there, about a film that's all about saving local cinemas and the big screen premiering on a small screen service.
But it is in cinemas as well. I think you can see it in
select cinemas.
Yeah, in select cinemas. So, I mean, I think most
people are going to be watching it at home.
On Sky Movies, which is who, you know, they've made it and it's going to be debuting there. But, you know, I think if there is a choice to go and see it at the cinema, this is the film to see at your local flea pit and pay your price and sit on your rickety chairs. I mean, that's what I liked about it. It's, as you say, it's incredibly predictable, even though it's a true story. It's just, you know, the full Monty and all of those things about, you know, trying to essay a town and the people that we all know. There's those type of people in every small town. But the thing that it really did capture really well was the importance of cinema in terms of as a community space and as a community activity. And, you know, they put on this old black and white film, not saying which one, but it's pretty obvious which one they might have put on. And people come and they are shocked by how moved they are by it, how brought together as a group they are by watching that film together. And, you know, there's lots of lens flare of seeing the, you know, the dust motes as the projector beams that film onto a screen and those, you know, red velvet seats and all of those things, you know, like the rubbish concession shop in the, you know, in the lobby that you used to go and buy your minstrels at or you know, just all of that is so taps into that nostalgia for anybody who loves cinema that I think it really works on that level alone.
And also, were you both singing You Saw the Whole of the Moon? Because, I mean, for me, that was the song of the big one. And that scene, I think, if there's one reason for you to watch it, is to see Eddie Lacter going up the stairs at his workplace with headphones and sunglasses, dancing to this.
I know, he's been everywhere this year. Yes. He's been in Ava and Ali. He turned up in The Electric Life of Louis Wayne. I mean, he's everywhere, this guy. He's amazing. But I don't think I've ever seen him do a real sleaze like this before. And I really quite enjoyed seeing him with his tinted glasses and his, you know, backhanders and his spivvy suit and his Mac being a bad guy. It was quite a pleasure to watch.
He just shows the whole sort of register of the film really as well, doesn't it? His performance. It's kind of so simply drawn, but, you know, enjoyable as it is anyway, you know.
Yeah, and he's just a buffoon.
Yeah, he's like a comically evil sort of mayor, isn't he? Like, he's just working with the developers for the money. It's just like, it's so kind of pantomime-y.
One thing for me is that, again, because I didn't know this had been a true story, then afterwards I was Googling to see who the real mayor was. Because it slightly, while I was watching the film, it irked me that it was an Asian character painted as the bad man and that Tom Felton was the one who kind of came in and saved the day. And that for me, while I was watching it, just did irk me. And also even with the Susan Wacoma's character, I felt like, oh, why is it that the one black girl in this town is shown as someone who has criminal tendencies, who can break in? And I felt like, oh, representation matters and all of this. But then I still kind of watched it through. And then once I knew these were all characters that were just brought in for the story and for effect, I thought, okay, it's fine. I'm okay with it.
And there is a link to a certain advert, isn't there, as well, that's quite surprising.
Yes, this was the thing that Jade had mentioned this to me beforehand, and then I forgot when I watched the film. And then at the end, I was like, oh my God.
Yes. So, yeah. It's a
fun film, yes, when you see those, like, oh, look at the real people at the end. Yeah. It's like,
and also nice, they, nice, and also those real people cameo in the film as well, if you have an eagle eye. So yes, it's a little bit of fluff and fun. And that is Save the Cinema, which is on Sky Cinema from Friday and in select cinemas. Do go to the select cinemas, support those cinemas. They'd love to see you. Mm. Hopefully they're selling minstrels in the lobby. Okay, shall we move on? It's time to talk plain talking, which is where we demystify phrases that are said on set and talk about what they actually mean. So this week we're talking about end board. Do you know what an end board is, Matt?
Avengers end board.
Yeah.
No, I don't.
Okay, so this is the clapperboard. So often, I think what we're most familiar with on films and what we see of films of filmmaking is that a clapperboard is used at the top of a scene and it's used the right way up and they clap it. They say, scene 24, take 3, and not clap the board. But sometimes people prefer to do an end board, which is where you do it at the end of the scene and you clapper it upside down, just so that you know what your take is. So that is an end board rather than the usual upfront clapper board. Okay, shall we move on to something very inside your head?
It's like a rumble from the core of the earth. Bang! And then it shrinks.
So this is Memoria, which has done well at festivals and is now coming out. Matt, explain it to us if you can.
Oh, I'll try. This is directed by Apichatpong Virasetakul, also apparently known as Joe, but I don't feel like it'd be impolite for me just to say Joe.
Joe to his friends. And are you friends with him?
No.
Then
best known for directing Uncle Boonmi, who can recall his past lives, to give you kind of, you know, a sense of the flavour of this film, you know, what you might be in for. And as you mentioned, starring Tilda Swinton. It is quite arresting to begin with, in the sense that Tilda Swinton's character, Jessica, she sort of wakes in the middle of the night and hears this sort of mysterious bang, basically, a weird mysterious banging noise. And then it kind of transpires that, you know, she's hearing this sound in her head and she basically just then goes on a sort of, you know, a journey to try and kind of get to the root of it. And, you know, she kind of meets a sort of sound designer. She tries to get to capture the sound and she kind of, you know, talks to other people about it and just goes on this weird kind of journey. And it's sort of all about that, really. And it's very sort of, I mean, every review I've read of this film says it won't be for everyone, even though most of the reviews have actually been very positive. Every review says it won't be for everyone. And I perhaps fall into that category of people it wasn't for. Because, I mean, you have to go into this in the right frame of mind, the right time, I think, you know, give yourself over to it. Like, I saw it at home and I think maybe it would be better in a cinema where you can just be fully kind of absorbed.
With a great sound system. I mean, you need a wonderful sound system for this as well, don't you?
Sound system. And I didn't mention as well that it's actually set in Colombia and, you know, there's some beautiful scenery and visuals, but it's like, it's all in such long, slow takes. There's some takes where people are just literally just sitting there or staring. Or
just tipping their head next to a river for ages.
And it's kind of exceptionally sort of indulgent in that sense. It does not rush itself. It absolutely is not a film that's kind of, you know, plot driven. You can sort of, you know, pass a lot of meaning from yourself. And clearly a lot of people have really kind of connected with this character's search for meaning. I can't deny there was something very beguiling about it and sort of very fascinating about it. Tilda Swinton's very good in it, you know, like it's a slightly different performance for her in a way, especially, you know, if you've recently seen her in the French Dispatch. It's a much more sort of, you know, down to earth and sort of very, very sort of unadorned sort of performance. You know, it's very, she plays it very low key.
Yeah, there's no teeth and wigs like in the French Dispatch. She's not standing up going, and then we saw this person go over here. She's very Tilda, isn't she? Did it take you on a journey, Ashanti? I mean, I think it's taken Matt on a very short journey to the shops and back. Did it take you further?
I have to say that it wasn't an easy watch. It was a bit like Drive My Car, which beautiful as a film as it was. Again, not perhaps my, you know, I don't naturally go towards films like this. But, you know, this was like Columbia's entry for the Oscars. This is one of those films that is a must watch, isn't it? Because, you know, it won the jury prize at Cannes. You know, Tilda Swinton can't go wrong with watching her in terms of looking at the craft and in terms of cinematography. So technically, this film has some of the best sound design, and a lot of us saw Sound of Metal and thought, wow. Mm-hmm. And then we see this and think, wow. Even when you watch the trailer, you hear that the bass, you could just feel it kind of hitting you. And that felt amazing to me as to how much interest they took in that aspect of filmmaking. And I'm glad that more and more people are doing that now, where sound design is becoming so important, from Dune to a film like this, which is absolutely beautiful. And for me, growing up as a Hindu, the idea of this sound she could hear and how it grounds her to the earth, that also was a little bit of a connection that I made, because the word Om, the sound Om, and you might hear it, you know, yoga people on TV.
They do it in meditation.
In meditation, you'll hear it. And the whole idea of that sound being inside you, but also being in the ground and in the earth. And that's a very ancient idea that I felt they'd explored a little bit. And I guess with the Apitapong being Thai, there's a lot of Hinduism in Thailand. So maybe that was part of his idea to bring this screenplay to fore. And there was a lot to like about this film, but yes, it's not the easiest of things to watch. And just like a lot of great films are tough to watch, but you watch them and you come out with a greater experience. And that's what I felt about this one.
Yes, you're right. It's not an easy watch. And you do, as Matt said, you have to give yourself over to it. You have to, you know, it's sort of like a gong bath. I don't know if you've ever had a gong bath, but it's like, if you were to go to a gong bath with the attitude that this is nonsense, you're not going to get anything out of it. And it's that, I suppose it's like exercise or anything. You get out of it what you put into it. I found it weirdly hypnotic. So the fact that nothing happened and things were very still, you know, I just was like, oh, that, I had a weighted blanket on me whilst I watched it, which might have helped. And so I really just found the whole process incredibly sort of hypnotic and calming and sort of meditative. But having said that, I don't think I'd ever watch it again. You know, it's interesting you mentioned Sound of Metal, Ashanti, because it is quite similar in the way that it really tries to get into that this experience, which is a real medical condition. Of just suddenly hearing this weirdness. I mean, I suppose it's akin to tinnitus, and I have experienced tinnitus, and that just that discombobulation of having a weird noise inside your head that you're like, how is that in me? And no one else can hear it. It's very, very strange. So I think it really captures that. And then to pop it in a totally different country where she feels sort of not really a part of that. So she's just dislocated from everything, the world. And it's this trying to find her way and her where she should be in terms of her head and her body. And then there's also that weird bit, you know, with the looking at skulls of ancient, you know, people that have been dug up, sort of this archaeological find. And there's trepanning involved there. You know, people have had their skulls drilled in order to release evil spirits. And this idea that this fighting with what's going on in your head has been going on for as long as humans have been alive, and that it's actually just a really ancient thing, and it's like goes back to that Om thing and everything else. So yeah, I sort of liked it whilst I was in it, and so I'd sort of recommend it for anyone wanting a sort of hypnotic experience. But then, as you say, Matt, it really isn't for everybody.
No, I mean, you've got to kind of go into it, like you say, you've got to go in the right frame of mind. Make sure you're in the mood for this kind of thing. And also, like, without giving anything away, it really has quite a bonkers ending.
Yes.
It's worth sticking around for it for that. Sort of makes you want to revisit it again almost. Like made me want to kind of think, right, I've got to watch this again really once you've kind of reached the end. I'll try and give it another go when I'm in a sort of suitably meditative state.
Yeah,
you know.
Mellow, like, ooh. Okay, so if you fancy a bit of a journey with Memoria, that is out in cinemas on Friday. Find a cinema with a good sound system. All right, it's time for alternative line reading, and you might be able to get this based on what we've just discussed. Are you ready? You're a man looking at the world through a keyhole, and you spent your whole life trying to widen that keyhole to see more, to know more. And now, on hearing that it can be widened in ways you can't imagine, you reject that possibility. Who said that in what film? Ashanti's waving.
Oh my gosh, Tilda Swinton herself. And
yes,
you might have gathered I'm a bit of a fangirl.
Yeah.
And, you know, the ancient one, when she was that in Doctor Strange, I just remember going into the IMAX to see that. And it was one of my first IMAX experiences. Weirdly, I've been watching things on the super screen a lot, but not on the IMAX. And this kind of a width of screen and this ancient one coming up and saying that, and you know, just know you don't want to mess with her, she is a boss. And then she delivered that line, and there it was.
And then she bashed Dr. Strange out of his body just to show him who was boss. So that sounds like this in real life.
You're a man looking at the world through a keyhole, and you spent your whole life trying to widen that keyhole to see more, to know more. And now, on hearing that it can be widened in ways you can't imagine, you reject the possibility.
No, I reject it because I do not believe in fairy tales about chakras or energy or the power of belief. There is no such thing as spirit. We are made of matter and nothing more.
Time to move on now. So this is Cow. This is Andrea Arnold's documentary, Matt, about a cow, right?
It is. I kind of did have to chuckle earlier when I looked on. I often, after watching a film, will look at IMDb's trivia, even though obviously it can be sort of dubious sometimes. There's just one piece of trivia for Cow, and it says, just about two cows that do cow stuff.
You know what? That pretty much sums it up.
That is all the trivia you need for this film. But yes, it's a documentary by Andrea Arnold, the filmmaker we kind of know best for American Honey. She did a version of Wuthering Heights, Red Road, Fish Tank, that kind of stuff. So, you know, really great director. And I think this is her first documentary. And it's really sort of interesting the way it's done. So we follow a dairy cow called Luma, and it's one of those kind of documentaries where we sort of follow her whole life, really. It's kind of, I think the whole process took about 4 years, and there's no kind of voiceover, there's no sort of titles, you know, to tell you anything. There's no kind of, you know, hard information in that sense. It just literally follows this dairy cow as she kind of, you know, gets pregnant, gives birth, gets the calf taken away, clanks around to another kind of, you know, like area, and gets various things, just experiences various things that go on in the life of a cow. And so it's kind of interesting. Again, it's another one that is extremely different to Memoria, but it also has that sort of like meditative kind of feel where you just sort of absorb it almost, you know, because of just that whole nature of it. You're not following a kind of story. I personally didn't feel like it was really trying to make you go one way or the other, almost, if you know what I mean. Like, it didn't feel like this was a sort of, you know, like, you know, like vegan propaganda or anything like that, you know, because it wasn't like unrelentingly awful. Yeah, it was just,
it does, it will make you think about dairy and
beef. Oh yes, it definitely will. Yeah, I'm not saying that, but I mean, at the same time, it doesn't hammer you like over the head with it, and doesn't feel like that was just entirely what it set out to do either, if you know what I mean. That just the vibe that I got. Maybe you guys feel differently, but it's kind of interesting and sort of fascinating. And yeah, I kind of like obviously found it quite moving as well, you know, like just this cow just like sort of like lovely eyes just staring into the camera a lot. And it's kind of sort of beautifully shot as well. Like there's some some nice scenes where it gets to eat some grass outside and like the sun setting. And it's just really interesting the way it's been edited as well, because all the kind of humans, you know, that kind of work on the farm, they're all kind of in the background and we never kind of clearly see their faces. You hear sort of little bits they say, which kind of give a bit of context, but it's very much from the cow's perspective, and the people are very much in the background. And then there's also, like, you know, you kind of hear bits of music that are just playing kind of in the farm, and that kind of adds something. And there's like a moment of fireworks, which kind of just, it just very, very weird, but I really got into it and was sort of touched by it.
Were you, Ashanti, did it do it for you?
Well, so I have recently seen an Oscar-nominated film, Ascension. It's a Chinese-American documentary film set in China about the Chinese dream and social classes. And similar to Cao, it's where the documentary maker, in this case, Jessica Kinden in Ascension, she just shows you these different scenarios. So she doesn't give you any commentary. She doesn't say to you, this is what I feel about it. There's almost no agenda. And that's how Andrea Arnold also has done this with Cao, where what you get to see is the life of a cow, you know? And interestingly, I had read a study saying that apparently they give you more milk if you give them the right type of slow music. You know, slow beats apparently does this. And University of Leicester had done a study on this with cows, and they give you a lot more milk about apparently if you give it the right music. And in this film, for me, coming from a kind of music background, you know, you hear the Pogues' Fairy Tale of New York, which is hardly a calming song, but you hear that and you see this kind of little Christmas setting and you see this huge kind of milking room. Part of it is, are you looking at this cow or the cows? They don't seem very happy in some instances.
And you're saying it's because they were listening to the Pogues and they should be listening to something better. Is that what you've got from this, Ashanti?
Well, there was Billie Eilish too. So, you know, it's like, I'm sure they were keeping them happy. I'm just wondering, because, you know, you see the people who work in this farm and how they are treating the cows, and they seem to be treating them as well as they can. It's just when they show us those scenes, we are sitting there thinking, oh, that looks brutal. That looks scary. Whereas I don't know how, and nobody knows, right, how these cows are feeling. But yes, in terms of music, I mean, should they have been playing Beethoven to the cows? Probably. But instead, they were playing music they liked, I suppose, and had the Pogues, which was quite interesting. But yes, overall, though, I just felt that this was a very beautifully made film. Again, this is not the sort of film I would normally seek out. And we've had Pig, we've had Cow, we've had Lamb, you know, we've had a lot of different films showcasing farming. You know, farming, you know, in a way. And I don't know if you and the listeners know, but a lot of Americans think that chocolate milk comes from brown cows. So these sort of films are there to show them. Yeah, I know. It's like they'd done a study and found that this is a fact that they thought, you know, chocolate milk just automatically came from brown cows, which made me laugh so much. So these are all things where I feel like some of these films are good to kind of educate people also, because a lot of people just assume, hey, I just go to the supermarket and that's where I find my chicken. So seeing where that chicken or that cow actually comes from and how that animal lives is quite eye-opening in many ways, even though you don't think it is. When I read the description of this film, I just thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to sit through, what is it, 94 minutes of, you know, just looking at a cow. But like Matt said, also that cinematography, this lady Magda Kowalczyk, she has done the cinematography for this, and it was really stunning, I should say, similar to when I saw Ascension, and I thought, wow, they have made something that seems so mundane and what's everyday life for these people or these animals look so beautiful on screen and just educates the viewer if you're open-minded enough to go and see it.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of, you mentioned those other films, the one it reminded me of was Gunda, which came out,
yes.
Which was about the pig, yeah. And it followed a mother pig and her piglets and in a very sort of, as you say, no agenda way. And yeah. I feel like this really works on that level, because you take meaning from it however you want to view it. I mean, you could say it's a comment on, you know, the women's, you know, lack of autonomy over their own bodies. You know, this cow is just used and milked and bread and other people make decisions. You could view it as a comment on being vegan or vegetarian. You could view it as, you know, a comment on should everybody know where all of their food comes from and be prepared to come to terms with how that's done. And some of those things are unpleasant and uncomfortable. And if you want your milk, you also have to know that horns are cauterized off little cows, that they're separated and that a mother never sees their baby. You know, is this something that I think you could watch, you know, if you'd had grief recently and, you know, lost a family member, that you would be able to read that into it. And that's what I found quite lovely about it, that you can project or take from it whatever you personally feel. And that means it's a film that is different for absolutely everybody that watches it. And as you say, it's beautiful. And the soundtrack is quite witty as well. There's, you know, there's a Milk by Garbage, which actually, you know, when you listen to those lyrics is sort of really quite sad when you've watched what you've watched. And I don't think I'd ever want to watch it again, but I'm glad I did. And I had sort of dreaded watching it because I think we can all expect what might be coming, and what you expect might be coming does come.
Yeah.
But it isn't done in any kind of provocative or awful way. I mean, honestly, you could have sung, you know, The Circle of Life from The Lion King with this as well, couldn't you? That it's very much about the life cycles of this cow. And yeah, I think it was very informative for me. And I will think about Milk and beef. And I'm, you know, Ashanti and I went out for dinner last night before we watched this. And I'm glad we didn't order beef, is all I'll say. So that is Cow, and that is out in cinemas from Friday. Okay, finally, should we get to our final film? Lead on, Macduff.
By the pricking of my thumbs, something wicked this way comes.
My husband. King that shall be.
If we should fail.
We fail.
So this is the tragedy of Macbeth, that old chestnut from a young up-and-comer called William Shakespeare. Matt, why is this different?
Again, maybe you're asking the wrong person. I'm not really like a true Shakespeare scholar, as maybe this discussion will soon realise. And I'm worried that today I'm going to come across as the Philistine of the group after this and Memoria. But I have to be honest. And obviously, I went into this with like very high expectations because it's directed by Joel Coen, having a brief sort of break from his brother Ethan and directing solo for a change. An incredible cast led by Denzel Washington as Macbeth and Frances McDormand as Lady Macbeth. So that's obviously a powerhouse couple there, you know, if there ever was one.
Oscar wins and a go-go.
Yeah, obviously, yeah, even if you're a kind of Shakespeare Philistine like me, you kind of vaguely know that the story is, you know, Macbeth and Lady Macbeth. And their sort of quest for power, really, by sort of killing the king and, you know, claiming the throne and, you know, where that all goes from there. And there's obviously, you may remember, there's witches involved. You know, there's a few of the famous Shakespeare quotes you'll obviously remember from this one. And yeah, so it's fairly faithful telling. It's pretty lean as well, in that it's kind of sort of an hour and 45, which for a Shakespeare is quite tight, I thought, you know. So
they've trimmed some bits.
Yeah, they've trimmed it and they kind of get through it. I must admit, I always struggle with the story of Macbeth. Like I wasn't over keen on even the Michael Fassbender one released recently, but I slightly preferred that one because I sort of like the earthiness of it and, you know, how kind of dirty it was. And this is the complete opposite in that sense, where what this really, for me, the main kind of selling point of this is this kind of incredible black and white cinematography by Bruno Delbonnel. And it's so kind of crisp, so stark, so stylized, so kind of, you know, almost noir-y. And it really feels like, kind of intentionally, it feels like it's sort of either on a set or almost kind of, you know, it was kind of making me feel like either like an old film on a set or maybe even just having a bit of a stage vibe, because it felt like they were all on quite a small location with almost like not much going on outside their immediate kind of environment, if that makes sense, like kind of the, as if they were on like a stage and the world didn't expand out much beyond where they were. But so the visuals I was entranced by, and Catherine Hunter is incredible as the witches, you know, and
yeah,
the way they kind
three.
Of handle that. Yeah, she plays them, her sort of physicality and just her whole performance. It was quite scary, you know, it has, you know, almost like leans into some horror aspects of it in a way. And so that I really appreciated that side of it. But the main story, I struggled with it. Again, as not a Shakespeare scholar, and like I never did Macbeth at school, I find they just come in as obviously full Shakespearean language and they just get straight into it. And I find myself thinking, like, who is this? Who are they talking to? Who are they talking about? Like, who's this new person who's just come in and it's like, you know, having a go at someone? Like, obviously you kind of, you know the basics of the plot with Lord and Lady Macbeth and what they're kind of up to. So I was able to kind of follow that strand, but to be completely honest, I struggled to appreciate the sort of finer details. I find myself shocked that I'm saying this. I didn't think it was possible to say this about anything, but I felt like Denzel Washington was miscast as Macbeth. He just, to me, he didn't work as Macbeth, and obviously he's one of the kind of all-time greats. And to me, it was an appealing idea on paper, but for some reason, it just didn't work for me on screen. Yeah. But I mean, am I just being an idiot? What did you guys think? I know this has got largely very positive reviews across the board. What did you guys think of it?
Oh, I'm in agreement, and I hate to say that because I love Denzel in pretty much everything, but I just didn't think he was right for this. He seemed to garble speeches, which he was trying to do in a sort of urgent fashion, but I couldn't understand what he was saying. And I don't know, it's difficult, isn't it? It's very difficult because it's his interpretation of this king and that's what he's doing with it, but it didn't work for me. And I also agree with you that the whole, it was like a set, very stagey. And that's when you're talking about a stage play, they're like, well, of course it is. But I think probably I prefer, if I'm going to watch a stage play on film, I want that to be more cinematic and more a larger world than the space that a stage takes up. And it felt very contained, very stylized, stunning. I mean, beautiful, and an exercise in gorgeous production and gorgeous cinematography. But did it move me? Not really. And you know, there's some cracking people in this. I really thought Alex Hassel is brilliant as Ross, this sort of sinister guy who's wearing this very slinky sheath dress and sort of whispering poison in different people's ears and doing some terrible things to children. You know, there's Brendan Gleeson, you've got Frances McDormand doing some excellent work, you've got Catherine Hunter, as you said, just doing this physicality that is actually the highlight of the film for me, when she turns up and is, hello, Macbeth, when shall we three meet again? This creepy voice and creepy arm movements and this bird motif that goes with her. All of the bits of it are great, but it doesn't
really
add up to
something. I really liked Corey Hawkins.
Corey Hawkins is really great.
As well. I thought he was really good.
Yes.
But it felt to me like an exercise in extremely kind of clever, talented people almost doing something for the sake of it, in the sense that it's obviously, you know, one of the all-time kind of, you know, famous stories, but I didn't really feel like this take on it really
showed it
to me in a new light, or added anything, or made me think of it in a different way, or, you know, made it sort of engaging for a modern audience or anything like that. I just felt it was just like, we'll have fun doing this. That's how it felt to me, just almost a bit indulgent in that sense.
Indulgent for you, Ashanti?
Yes. And I feel like, you know, and this is the case where Joel and Ethan normally work together. In this case, Joel said, Ethan's not interested in this kind of subject matter. I'm going to have to take a stab at this. And I want to take a stab at this because I'm interested in this. So he's gone in without his creative partner, which obviously takes away a lot from how he works normally. And secondly, I feel like he has worked on this project to make it for television, as in Apple TV is where it's going to be screened. So a lot of the shots even you see are made for the small screen rather than the big screen in many ways. Though it's beautiful, it would be beautiful to watch on the big screen. There are lots of things he's thought of. And it was quite interesting because the two main stars in it, Denzel and Frances, are Americans, and the rest of the cast mostly apart from Corey, are British, you know, and it's interesting to see these two people trying to take on those accents that are just not natural to them. And maybe that also gives you a slight disjolt, which is probably another reason why you both felt like, ooh, I'm not 100% bought into it. And I also felt the same, because I went into it maybe with too high expectations, just thinking, oh my gosh, we're going to see Denzel and Frances come together. And then to see what they've actually output did feel like it's lacking for me. And I feel like they made this for awards bait. It feels like they just said, okay, we're just going to put all these thespians together, all this talent on screen. Let's see if it wins some awards. But I felt it fell short. And probably because we have seen many versions of Macbeth. Most of us grew up on Shakespeare. And maybe this will work better for an American audience. I'm wondering, because they may not be as tuned into that story that we've seen again and again. You know, we've read the book, we've dissected it in school, we've
done it at GCSE. You know,
exactly. We've then gone to the theater and we're like watching it on school trips and stuff. So it's almost ingrained in us, isn't it? And we have a certain idea of how the thespians of stage put it out. And then we're seeing two very different actors coming together for it. So perhaps there's a little disconnect there as well.
Yeah. It is, as you say, it's going to be on Apple TV. But it is also in select cinemas, so you can watch it on the big screen. It is available from Friday, so you can watch it small or big screen and enjoy The Witch, as I think we can all agree. That is it for this week. Those are the films. What was your film of the week, Matt?
For me, it would have to be Scream, just for sort of, you know, the fun of revisiting the franchise and sort of seeing it in a cinema. But I did like Cab a lot as well.
Yeah, Ashanti, how about you?
I'm also going to go with Scream. I didn't think I would, but I am, just because there was a female element to it and the LGBTQ plus element, and those positive elements for me drew me into it. And it's one of those films that, you know, don't go into it with a serious mind trying to dissect it too much. Just go into it, watch it for what it is, and then go and have a nice dinner afterwards.
Yeah, go for the ride. I think I'd probably say, and I would not have put money on this when we first looked at this list of films, but Cow. I really found that extremely, as you say, moving and surprising when it's incredibly and deceptively simple. So Cow. Okay, so just to remind you that our current issue is on sale with Tom Holland and Mark Wahlberg on the cover for Uncharted. Have a read of that. And if you want to get on board the Total Film train, we have a special listener offer for 3 issues of Total Film for £3. I mean, that's a bargain, isn't it, Matt?
Can't beat it, can you? Come
you on. Cannot. If you want to get that special offer, go to www.magazinesdirect.com/insidepod and you can select your preferred subscription package. And if you do that, you'll get your mag delivered to your door early before anyone else. You'll never miss an issue, so it won't be sold out and you're like annoyed down at Smith's. You pay less than you would down in the high street, and you get subscriber exclusive covers and content. I mean, what's not to love? That web address again is www.magazinesdirect.com/insidepod. Right, before we go, we have time for a reader's question. This is a good one. What's the best scene in the rain from a movie, Matt?
I mean, there's absolutely loads you could go for, but if I'm honest and go for the very first one that popped into my head, it would have to be the kind of first T-Rex attack in Jurassic Park, just because the rain is so kind of important. So it's one of my kind of, again, another sort of real formative cinema memory. And I just think it's just one of the best kind of set pieces of all time. So that's just what sprung to mind when I think of rain on screen.
Lovely. First of all, let me just say the upside down kiss in Spider-Man. Kirsten Dunst and Tobey Maguire, can't go wrong with that. That was stunning. And as someone who grew up on Indian cinema, that just brought it all home for me. Then in The Notebook, you know, Rachel McAdams and Ryan Gosling, I absolutely love that film. And that scene was just magic. And there's this epic fight scene from the Tamil film Kala with superstar Rajinikanth. And he's a superstar because even Japan loves him. You have all these Japanese memes of people trying to be superstar Rajinikanth. He is loved in India. There's this very slick fight scene with this great choreography, a brolly that helps him, ample slow motion shots, Santosh Narayanan's thumping score. So in Kala, that was one scene. If you Google it, you can check it out, K-A-A-L-A.
I had to narrow this down as well. And so one of my favorites is Breakfast at Tiffany's, when they go out in the rain to find Kat. And she decides that actually she might want to form a proper relationship with George Peppard's neighbour and Kat. And they kiss in the rain with Kat scrunched, annoyed between them. Love the cat's face in that scene. It's like, oh, no, I'm in the rain. I'm being squashed between people. This is the worst cat life. Love that. Also, obviously, we can't not mention Blade Runner and Time to Die. Obviously one of the best.
Yes, that was it. That
one
was
song. I just have to throw in there, it's not one of my favorites, but it's one that just I always remember, that scene in Four Weddings and a Funeral, when she turns up on the front door to declare her love after the final wedding, and he mentions that it's raining, and she says in a tone that is so weird that I've never forgot it, "Is it raining? I hadn't noticed." And it's like, did nobody want her to do that line reading again? Apparently that's romance. So those are my rain things.
Because they comment on it. That was another one I thought of as well, because you just, you know, you have to think of that, don't you? When you think of rain, that I hadn't noticed.
Wow. Okay, reading that off of a large white board behind him or something. I don't know what's going on there. For that very reason, it's sort of like weirdly awful and awkward. So those are mine. So on that note, shall we say a rainy goodbye to our listeners? And we'll be back next week for more reviews of films coming out. Next week, we'll have things like Belfast to talk about. So come back and join us. So say goodbye, Matt.
Bye.
Say goodbye, Ashanti.
Bye, everyone. Go out and see Belfast and listen to the podcast about it, because that's one of my favourite films that has come out in the last God knows how many years.
Okay, and it's goodbye from me.
Is it still raining? I hadn't noticed. Crescent.